Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social, or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals, and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
So good morning, Felicity. How are you? I think you've just hot-footed it back from your trip to Brussels.
I have, and it was wonderful. The Christmas decorations are all up, all the famous buildings are lit up, and it all looked lovely. But you've just come back from Australia. How was that?
It was fabulous, actually. Thank you. It was really great. Got to spend lots of time with various wine businesses, and really privileged to deliver the keynote at the Australian Women in Wine Conference, where I was talking about why women matter in wine. But I guess that's a question perhaps for another episode. So today, shall we get on with today's question?
Let's get on with today's question, with the question from a very real person who actually exists, I assume.
Yes, and you always question on me about whether these people actually exist. I don't make it up, Felicity. You know me, always truth and data. So today we are exploring a question that came directly to me from my friend Chris, who lives in Delaware in the US. And recently, a few weeks ago, I was over in the US and he and I happened to be out wine shopping, as you do, in one of his favourite wine stores. We were a bit tight for time, so I kind of said to him, look, you know, let you guide. It's your local store. You know the wines. What do you think we should have? So he was sort of showing me his top picks, his current top picks. And when I asked him, you know, why are these your top picks? He said that one of the reason was because they had got good scores. So then Chris asked me, I'm not sure if it's just marketing or if it's real, but do award-winning wines taste better?
Ah, so that's a question that many, many people ask. And I guess we should start by talking about what those scores are, because there's two types. One is scores awarded by critics and one is scores awarded by wine competitions.
Yeah, and you see so many different types of awards and medals and points. You know, they come from the retailers, give their prizes and points, or wine regions like the Australian capital cities. There's critics, there's competitions like the OIV standards. There's sommelier picks. You know, the list is endless. So to give us some context for this discussion, what would you say are the key similarities and differences between the awards, the medals and the critics? So these different types of shows or competitions.
Right. Let's get the critics out of the way first. So for most of the 20th century, being a wine critic was pretty genteel. So you sat and you wrote your impressions of a wine. And often what you wrote, these were all men, you wrote an incredibly sexist thing about the wine, calling it female or feminine or worse. But all of that changed with the emergence of a wine critic called Robert Parker in the 1970s. He was an American lawyer who'd fallen in love with wine while visiting France, and he started a newsletter called The Wine Advocate, which was inspired by Ralph Nader, the consumer advocate.
Just Nader, so I know that name. Wasn't he something to do with cars?
That's right. He wrote a book about car safety in the mid-1960s that revealed there was a Chevrolet model whose steering wheel would spear you if you had a crash, among other sort of horrors. So his book led to new safety standards, including the seatbelt, and it also kicked off an interest in telling the truth about consumer products.
Okay, so we're now talking about cars. What's this got to do with wine?
So before Robert Parker came along, most people who wrote about wine were members of the wine trade. So they often had a vested interest in the wines they were writing about, or they were friends with producers and didn't want to rock the boat by giving less than glowing reviews. So Parker decided that he was going to bust this open. He was going to be completely independent and honest in his reviews. He was going to be a true consumer advocate. And he did that by awarding wines a score out of 100.
Okay, so was this the first time that that kind of scoring system out of 100 was widely used?
Yes, and he was very mocked and criticised for this. But the public loved it because it was easy to understand. So these scores had a huge impact in retail because the scores would end up, you know, on the shelf somewhere, on something called a shelf talker, and all the 90-plus score wines would fly off the shelves, and so his taste began to dominate the market.
Okay, so that wouldn't work if people hated his choices, but kind of clearly they didn't, because you're just saying that the wines flew off the shelves. So effectively, he didn't just sort of start selling wines, but producers started to make wines that actually suited his taste or his palate to then get these higher scores.
Yes, and he came along at a perfect time when the wine market, particularly in the US, was beginning to expand. So you had a lot of people who weren't, shall we say, experienced tasters, and the wines that they liked were fruitier, more alcoholic, bigger, easier to understand, sometimes called fruit bombs, and this happened to be his taste as well. So for consumers entering the market, he was offering a very safe and reliable choice. But long before he retired in 2019, people were already tiring from that style of wine.
So when you say people, what you mean, like wine connoisseurs? So Felicity, remember that, you know, wine knowledgeable people or wine connoisseurs don't represent the mainstream of the wine market. So rich red blends of wine are still popular.
That is very true. Yes, that's correct. Anyway, so back to the scores. So although all the other wine critics hated the 100-point scale and typically were very jealous of his influence, a majority of people ended up adopting it because consumers liked it so much. And in fact, today there are even wine data services that aggregate the scores of leading critics and use them to make price recommendations for investment-grade wine. And indeed, some of these systems score the critics. They know which critics are more likely to move the market than others.
Okay, so are they still important?
Yes, in fine wine. So these are so important that a group of Italians even went so far as to rent time on the European Sentinel satellite system. And they've created a service called Saturnalia, which looks at vineyards in significant areas, 50 centimetres by 50 centimetres, and monitors what's happening in the field. So one of Saturnalia's services is an attempt to predict the score of the wine before the grapes are even picked.
Okay, so that's a kind of summary or a discussion about the critics. What about the competition? So I know you've been a wine judge. What do you think of wine competitions?
I think they're very stressful and a lot of work. You sit down and you taste literally dozens of wines in a morning or a day, and you come up with a score that describes them. A friend calls it the world's worst superpower, being able to distinguish minute differences between one liquid and another.
Okay, so my question actually was more, what do you think of the results?
Oh, right, sorry, Lily.
Rather than actually your time sitting slurping your way through hundreds
okay,
of wines.
Okay, fair
in
question.
Day.
Okay, so how good it is depends on the competition. So I grew up with the Australian wine show system, which is a very structured system that grew out of the 19th century agricultural show system.
Okay, so I am familiar with agricultural show systems, having been the proud recipient of a cup for my flower arranging in the local village.
No, really? When was that?
That was quite a few years ago, but I still have the cup and I'm very proud of it.
Oh, you should be. Oh, that's amazing. You didn't put cakes in the competitions as well, did you?
No. My baking, I think, is not quite of the standards of my flower arranging, although we have to, we have to know that this is my local village show.
I think you should be proud of yourself.
Yes.
Okay, so but the Australian wine shows sprang up as part of the agricultural system, and the goal was to solve a very serious problem. In the early days of the colony, the preferred drink was rum. So some winemakers tried to entice new wine drinkers into the market by adulterating their wines to make them closer to rum.
Okay, so like what? What makes a wine compete with rum?
I'm glad you asked. So people added spirits to fortify them, but according to one academic thesis I got my hands on, they distilled the spirits in what she called, quote, inappropriate metals, which, quote, resulted in severe contamination and toxicity, chronic addiction, delirium, tremens, paralysis, madness, and even death.
Seriously?
Now, at the time, this is the 1850s, some enterprising winemakers were also looking to export. So raising the quality and reputation of the local wines was critical, as was not killing people.
Yeah, well, that would be good. So in all of this, who was actually judging the wines?
Other winemakers. And this actually contributed to the success of the Australian wine system as a whole, because it meant that people were very collegiate and they were always sharing ideas about how to improve quality. They called it improving the best of breed, being that agriculture thing. So this gave rise to what is now a formal show structure, where you start out as an associate judge and you have to prove yourself, and eventually you work your way up to becoming a full fledged judge, and it's very prestigious.
So that's basically effectively the system that's still in place today.
That's right. And you have to train to be part of it, and there's a hierarchy. So a big city show like the Royal Adelaide Wine Show is the most prestigious, but there are small regional shows as well.
Okay, so that's where we see the kind of gold, silver, bronze medals coming from.
That's right. But at the competition itself, wines are scored out of 20. And I should mention that the Australian Wine Research Institute even offers a wine assessment course for would-be judges or for experienced judges who want to brush up their skills. It is a very rigorous program of tasting.
Gosh, yes. And so that's the system that's used in the rest of the world?
No. There are lots of different systems and very few countries use Australia's. The most common style of judging that you'll find in continental Europe is something called the OIV system. It was designed in France by bureaucrats from the Organisation of Vines and Wines. And it's quite bureaucratic. You're not told anything about the wines and you sit ticking off boxes on a sheet. So it gives you little boxes for, is this wine clear? What are the aromas like? And so on, with a total score out of 100. So usually what you do is you sit and look at the sheet, you taste the wine, you decide in your head what score you're going to give it, and then you work backwards to tick off the matching score boxes.
Gosh, that sounds actually quite complicated. So in your opinion, which of the systems that you're talking about is better?
So I have a very strong opinion about this.
Oh, really, Felicity? That's
however, I also am involved in many different competitions, so I should be tactful.
Yes.
And mention that the OIV system has occasionally been criticised for a number of things, including the fact that it doesn't allow judges to speak to one another. So, you know, this is really important, because if you're judging a wine style that nobody has any experience in, you might have somebody at the table who has a lot of experience who can explain it, but you're not allowed to have that in the OIV system. So the end result is it's a lot like judging in a sensory deprivation chamber, which is not, of course, how wines are actually drunk. So as it happens, many competition organisers find the OIV system too rigid, so they modify it in some way. And the other key point about the OIV system is that it demands that you have a number of judges from different countries, so you get a wider view. And in practice, what this means is that people come from markets with wildly different consumer patterns. And so there's a lot of disagreement about the judging. And you also, because of the number of people demanded, get judges of variable experience, to put it tactfully. Though, in my experience, most judges will agree with one another on outstanding wines or on wines that suck. It's the wines in the middle that generate the most disagreement and discussion.
Yeah, and that doesn't surprise me, given that the sort of differences there between the, you know, the really top scoring or bottom scoring, but it's that bit in the middle. So when we're talking about competitions, you haven't talked so far about the British competitions. So what's your view or experience on that?
Okay, so these competitions are highly respected, and this is partly because the UK is home of the big wine bodies like the Institute of Masters of Wine. So it has more wine experts per head of population than probably anywhere else in the world. And what makes these competitions different is that they will only use acknowledged experts on each country or style to judge those relevant wines. So a gold medal from one of these competitions is highly sought after.
Okay, so basically you're saying in these competitions, to be a judge, you have to be an expert in the specific
Yes.
category or the specific wine type, as opposed to just an generalist expert, which is what you were talking about earlier.
That's right. And the other thing about most of these competitions where you can talk to each other is you have to justify your wine choices, your scores. If you say wine is a you know, fabulous trophy winning wine, you're going to have to talk the other judges round.
Yeah. So in the sort of competition landscape, I'm wondering, are there kind of specific wine styles or certain wine styles that always get high scores?
There are. And I've seen this again and again, and it always stuns me. Dessert wines get 90 plus points, if not 97 or 98. Suddenly people start scattering gold like dust. And yet this is the category of wine which fewer and fewer people actually drink.
So that kind of makes me think, is it because wine experts, wine critics, wine judges have a higher preference for dessert wine styles than general consumers?
Well, I think everybody loves dessert styles when they actually taste them. It's just there's not that many places to drink them. No, I think I think it's because it could be because judges know how difficult these wines are to make, or maybe it's just the sugar level is so delightful after a morning of, you know, highly tannic reds that everyone just goes, woohoo.
Yeah, possibly. So we hear a lot about score inflation. So, you know, do all wines get over 90 points these days?
No, but many, many, many do. And the reason for that is wine quality has skyrocketed in recent years, so higher scores were always inevitable. But it's also true that there has been competition among some critics to give higher and higher scores to show how discerning they are. But it's not true of everybody. Right, so now I've talked about where scores come from. It's your turn. Do scores affect consumer perceptions?
Well, yes, they do. So there's kind of, let's start with two, what I think are sort of two important underlying psychological, sociological principles that let's explore those just for a moment.
This is a podcast dedicated to exploring the world of drinks, uncovering the drivers of the market. It's an interesting topic, but we've got a driver of our own.
That's right, Felicity. We're using this podcast to share our knowledge and experience.
So let me introduce you to the amazing Luli Halsted. She spent more than 30 years working with wine and spirits businesses around the world. Anybody who knows her knows she's not just a globally respected researcher, but she's a complete data nerd who specializes in understanding drinks trends, consumers, and how to build drinks brands that are profitable. She spent her career focusing on understanding the motivations behind why we drink what we do and what drives our choices. I met her back in 2008 when she was wowing an audience in Sweden with her insights, and she's awesome.
Wow, that's very kind and kind of quite humbling, Felicity, so thank you. Let me introduce you. So Felicity Carter, as I'm sure many of our listeners will know, is internationally renowned and award-winning journalist, editor, and researcher. And she's worked in Europe, the US, UK, Australia. She is one of the most respected authorities on the international wine business. She goes into businesses and sorts out their communication strategies, whether they want a better way to speak to customers or they want to develop a content strategy. And most people don't know about her is that she's also a ghostwriter of books.
So we became friends through our shared passion for understanding the underlying trends and future opportunities in drinks.
Yes, indeed we did, Felicity. And that's why we started this podcast, A Question of Drinks. And you can get in touch if you'd like us to help your drinks business navigate future opportunities and, most importantly, set out a strategy to grow profitably.
And we come as separate individuals.
We do indeed. You can find us both on LinkedIn, Felicity Carter or Luli Halsted, or please connect and drop either of us a DM.
Or get in touch via aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
Let's start with what I think are sort of two important underlying psychological, sociological principles let's explore those just for a moment. So the first comes from Pierre Bourdieu. Again, I'm butchering the French language, so apologies.
Your French
out
is
there.
Lovely, Lily.
Thank you. So he was a real kind of seminal author, a French sociologist who wrote a book actually in 1979, so going back quite a few years, called Distinction, A Social Critique of the Judgment of Taste. So he argues that taste, so that's taste when it comes to music or art, but also actually in food, so the kind of physical taste and therefore can carry across to wine, it's not just a sort of individual aesthetic preference. So it's not just what we like personally, but actually it's much more deeply influenced by our social class and our cultural background. So two of his key theses are that taste is a social marker. So it indicates our social position. So if we have higher social class, we have developed tastes that distinguish us from lower classes. And so it kind of reinforces hierarchies. His other kind of key thesis was about cultural what he calls cultural capital. So that's knowledge and education and cultural practices enable us to sort of influence this social power. So people from a higher social strata tend to have more cultural capital. And this allows us to sort of appreciate more refined and legitimate products. So if we build on his theories, if a wine is deemed to be award-winning, it can sort of carry more social capital.
Oh, I just want to jump in on that. One of my theses is that when I was growing up, cultural capital accrued to people who knew about symphonies. And now nobody cares about whether you know about classical music or literature or ballet. But in my lifetime, it's flipped to do you know about food and wine. So when any of my friends say, can you cook? They don't mean, can you throw something together? What they mean is, can you make something of almost restaurant quality? And I think that's, and I think that is what's driving so many people towards things like wine education.
Yeah, absolutely. And because it's a sort of manifestation, as you say, of the kind of social capital.
Yeah. Anyway, so I cut you off. Carry on.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Cool. So the second sort of principle, which I think is really interesting to look at, which is a sort of underlying psychological or behavioural science, as we kind of call it now, principle, is that we choose wine and impact a score or the impact that a score or medal might have comes from the fantastic late great Danny Kahneman. So Thinking Fast and Slow. So we have our brains have these kind of two basic ways of processing information. The system one, that's our fast thinking. So that's our automatic, quick, intuitive, effortless. Most importantly, it's super low energy for our brains. The other type of thinking we have is the system two thinking. So this is much more deliberate, analytical, logical. And this requires much more processing speed in our brains. So this uses tons of energy. So as animals, which we are, our bodies, our brains like us to operate in system one. So this kind of fast, lower energy thinking. So what wine awards and medals can do is they can help us act as a heuristic. So this kind of shortcut into system one, because it means we don't have to spend lots of time evaluating all of the other credentials on a bottle of wine, because that award or those points are enabling us to use a kind of heuristic, that shortcut to decision making. So that becomes a way of doing that and enabling us to shortcut using medal scores and awards.
I believe that. I remember talking to a New York retailer who said they went around and they just put gold dots on bottles, and those bottles sold faster than the others. But okay, so is there any evidence that awards, points, and medals work for us when we choose wine?
Yeah, so there is evidence. So it's interesting. I was actually asked this question recently. I was in Argentina and had the pleasure of being at a dinner with eight or so CEOs and owners of brilliant wineries in Argentina. And a core topic of conversation around the dinner table was they were all saying, particularly from their US distributors and importers, that they were being asked to present wines that had awards and points and medals because their importers, their distributors in the US were saying that this was super important to consumers.
Mm.
So I actually looked up the data and looked up the IWSR data to kind of find out, well, actually, how important is it to consumers to, you know, in this decision hierarchy or in this heuristics? So if we measure, if we look at choice cues, so let's stay with the example of the US, and this is, again, IWSR data amongst regular wine drinkers in the US, and we look at what choice cues are impacting consumers. So is it grape variety, a brand they're aware of, wine that complements food, the taste, recommendation from family and friends, region, country, etc. So we've got 15 choice cues in total, two of which are medals and awards. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you look at the data from a consumer point of view in the US, critics rank 12th out of these 15 choice cues, and awards or medals rank 14th. So actually, right, they're pretty low down the list from a consumer point of view. And there's lots more that will influence consumers' choices ahead of critics and medals.
Is this self-reported? Is this people telling you what's most important to them?
Yeah.
Because I wonder if people say, you know, medals aren't very important. And yet I think back to my friend in New York who can see that if you put something that distinguishes the bottle, people will buy it.
Yeah, and I think it's when you're asking, so when you're doing consumer research, obviously, if we could kind of go back to our system one and our system two brains, when you're responding to research questions, you're in your system two brain because you're deliberately thinking about your response to the question, as opposed to your system one brain, which is the sort of quick, intuitive way that you're making decisions. But I think that, you know, there is a lot of credibility in the data from a consumer point of view, which means, you know, you start off by going, well, actually, what flavour or taste of wine am I after? You know, what's the grape variety? What's the brand? Actually, that's more of a reassurance potentially than the awards or medals.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
It's also, again, if we delve down into the data, so we're looking at comparisons between different types of drinkers in the US. Again, this is IWSR data. Medals and awards actually start to become more important to younger wine drinkers over more experienced and older wine drinkers. Yeah. Yeah. And the reason for that is that for younger drinkers, obviously, you've had less experience or time in the wine category, so you're looking for more reassurance. You're trying to find ways to navigate a category that you're less familiar with, whereas more experienced, i.e. older wine drinkers have had a lot longer in the category, so have sort of built up their personal experience of what it is that they actually like. So, yeah, there's definitely a skew towards rising importance of these kind of external third-party endorsements amongst newer-to-wine drinkers.
Right.
But that's the US. If we, you know, let's take a completely different type of wine consumption market. So let's think about, for example, Brazil. So again, if we look at these 15 choice cues amongst regular wine drinkers in Brazil, IWSR data, again, we see medal, as in importance for consumers, ranks 13th, and award 14th, along with critic. So all of this discussion on awards and medals and points and prizes, I guess it's making me wonder how consistent and reliable the awarding process is. So can the judges or the critics judge quality more consistently?
This is one of the big questions that comes up all the time. So wine competitions do try and control for this by something called doubles, which means they submit the same wine twice to see if you'll score it the same. In general, people don't, because your taste is affected by sweetness levels. So if the wine you just tasted had a higher level of sugar, then the next wine will probably taste bitter.
Okay, so does all that mean then that if you are a judge, if you're in the judging process, you can't be objective because of that?
No, funnily enough, because of what I said earlier, which is what I've observed is that generally experienced tasters will all be able to identify the outstanding wines and the really bad ones, so at either end of the curve. Yeah. It's really the middle wines that people argue about, often because they're trying to give the wines the benefit of the doubt or because they're new to the wine style. If they are new to the wine style, that's really where people are completely unreliable. So the more experienced the judges are in a particular style of wine, the better they are. So everybody can tell you what a great Cabernet Sauvignon is, though the judging might be all over the place when it comes to an obscure grape variety. Mm. The other thing is Katrina Axelson of Tastry, which is the chemistry sort of analytics company, has done a lot of consumer research, and she tells me that people are pretty consistent, and the most thing they're consistent about is wines that they dislike. That people won't say, I dislike this wine one day and then suddenly like it another day. Anyway, there is some inconsistency in terms of how many points that you'll score it at any given time. But I don't think a point or two makes any difference. Is this wine a gold medal for you? Then that's what it's going to be if you are an experienced taster.
Mm. Yeah. So I suppose that then that this is a kind of good place to talk about lots of studies that have been done that basically, in summary, show that cheap wines do as well as expensive wines. So, for example, the study in 2011, a blind taste at the Edinburgh Science Festival with 578 members of the public that correctly identified the cheap or expensive wine only 50% of the time.
So listeners can't see my frowny face, but Luli can see it. So what do you think about these experiments, Luli?
It's something I keep saying, that wine experts have a different view of the world from consumers. And I see that through all my experience of researching amongst consumers. But I suppose the question here is that does that make them, the experts, or consumers, right or wrong?
Well, this is a question that's actually come up in the arts for well over 100 years. And the question is always, if the public loves something but the critics don't, who's right? I mean, there are many, many examples from literature of massive bestsellers that critics hated that were popular for a short time and then disappeared, never to be seen again. In general, the difference between the critics and everybody else is the critics bring an analytical lens to the task and judge something against its peers, while the public tends to react viscerally and emotionally to what's in front of them. So the New York Times did a 2014 study of film critics versus the public and discovered the public were much more forgiving than the critics were. It's very hard to please critics, especially who've, you know, seen it all before and can compare it to something from 10 years ago. So what I would expect in wine then is that if a critic gives a high score, it's probably really good, provided that it's something that you already like.
Because they're tougher, because I guess it's, you know, it's kind of partly because it's their job. You know, it's their job to critically evaluate.
That's right. So if you personally really love oat chardonnays, then a critic who scores
well
an oat chardonnay fairly high, yeah, well, you'll probably like the wine. But if you hate oak chardonnays, then and you taste a gold medal winning wine, you'll think, well, that sucks.
Mm. Okay, so what about the conflict of interest then in wine competitions? Because, you know, I think this is a really important area to think about. Because after all, you have to pay to enter these competitions. Mm. And some of them, you know, the fees are high. So entering not just one, but multiple bottles of, you know, vintages or SKUs or types of wine that you have even within one winery or one estate, you know, that can be really expensive to do. Yeah. So are the competitions basically just money spinners?
They are for the most part, but that doesn't make them wrong. So I've been at the back end of many of these competitions, and I will say that the good ones are organised blind. So the tasters have no idea what the wines are, and they give honest feedback. I have heard of corrupt competitions, but these are competitions that people in the industry already know are corrupt. So the only way they enter their wines into them is because they know they're going to get a medal. But I should say, out of all the dozens and dozens of wine competitions in the world, I know of only two that fall into this category, and they are generally poorly regarded. Their scores almost never show up in the retail environment. Mm. And in general, high quality judges won't judge at these competitions, so they just grab any warm body. But anyway, this is all just my opinion. What does your data say about the agreement between experts?
Yep. So there are, of course, a number of studies that have been done on this. So we can look at the sort of typical agreement or difference between critics to see whether they're judging or evaluating in the same way. So there's been some analysis done, for example, of two of the, you know, the great critics that are so highly regarded, Robert Parker and, of course, the amazing Jancis Robinson. So if we look, so they evaluate in different ways. Jancis uses a 20-point scoring system, as you've talked about earlier. Robert Parker used and now Wine Advocate use a 100-point system. But if you normalize, so adjust for that and look at how many wines on average Robert Parker gives 100 points to versus Jancis giving 20 points to, you'll see that Robert is more favourable. So it's a small percentage, so 0.38% of the wines evaluated by him get 100 points, and that compares to 0.05% of wines evaluated by Jancis get 20 points.
Interesting.
So you could say she is more critical or he is less critical, whichever way round we want to think about it.
Generous, but there
is,
I think.
Yeah, generous. Yes, okay, let's put it as generous. But there is some variation in how those two, you know, we take those two people as, you know, probably the kind of most highly regarded or two of the most highly regarded tasters and critics that have influenced consumers globally.
Interesting.
Yeah, so there's also another great study that also starts to explore this as well. So this comes from the Journal of Sociology, again, published back in 2011. And it's so you're going to like this one, Felicity. The title of the paper is Judging Taste and Creating Value, The Cultural Consecration of Australian Wine. So this study looked at you were talking about the Royal Adelaide Wine Show earlier. So it looked at the four capital city wine shows and the National Wine Show in Australia. So to the point we were making earlier, I think that one of the first sort of interesting things, not surprisingly, is that larger scale wineries put more entries into competitions than smaller scale wineries. Which makes sense logically. They have more wines, different types, but also they have more accessibility through funding to be able to do that, to the point we were talking about earlier that it's expensive to enter your wines into the competitions. So we could surmise that the medals and awards are stacked in favour of the larger producers or the larger scale wineries as a result of that.
Yes. And the other thing is that the bigger wine companies typically make wines that are geared towards the centre of the bell curve that the maximum number of people will like.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you've got judges and you have to average out and they have to agree on something, they're probably going to choose those wines.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the first sort of really interesting findings from the study. They also found that they characterised from a statistical point of view as a moderate agreement between the ratings of the judges in the four wine shows. So basically what they did was they looked at wines that were entered in multiple shows so that they could compare the judging from the judges across the shows. They found moderate, as I said, that's the word they use, moderate consistency between the agreement of the ratings of the judges between the shows. To your point earlier that you were talking about this kind of bell curve, what they found was that there was more consistency in the does it get a medal or does it get no medal at all, but less consistency in does it get a gold, a silver or a bronze. And actually the outcome there was pretty mixed in between the competitions. You were also talking earlier about the, you know, the kind of more known wines or styles of wines being more consistently judged. And that's exactly what they found. So in the Australian competitions, there was a higher level of agreement between the judges, particularly for Chardonnay and Shiraz.
Mm.
They suggest that this probably stems from the fact that these varieties have long been popular in Australia, and that for the judges, they have a more developed and refined taste for sort of standards way of evaluating those two specific varietals because they have more familiarity with them.
Mm.
So what they also found to the converse of that was that actually there were pretty low level of agreement between the judges, between the competitions for example, Riesling and Sauvignon Blanc. So they're what they deemed as statistically fair levels of agreement. So really not agreeing that much. And again, they put this down to the fact that the judges are less experienced in tasting Riesling and Sauvignon Blanc. Maybe less experience isn't quite the way to put it, but less familiarity with the variation between Riesling and Sauvignon Blanc styles of wine.
Now, far be it for me to question researchers, but I'm going to disagree with that finding, because I think when you're looking at judging, what you should be looking at is the consistency between the judge and their scoring. But the fact that judges disagree on something, I don't think is a fatal flaw, because as humans, we don't agree on aesthetic things anyway. Like, you can find film critics who vigorously disagree with one another about the merits of different films. In general, what you'll get in sort of aesthetic things is you'll get people having a general agreement on whether the construction of the thing is good or not. So a good wine critic should be able to tell by the shots and the cinematography whether it's been done well.
Mm.
But then they'll have a massive disagreement about whether the overall thing works. And I don't think that wine should be different. I think we often expect that humans should be in agreement about wine where we're not in agreement about other things. But the critical question for me is the individual judge consistent in their findings? I do find it interesting that this does agree, though, that Chardonnay and Shiraz typically are scored more in line with each other, because this comes to what Jamie Good calls the community of taste, that if you hang around other people for long enough, you get a sort of shared sense of what is aesthetically pleasing and what's not, that it's very socially mediated. Anyway, enough of that. What about price?
Yeah, well, hang on a minute. I'm going to go back. I'm going to counter you. I'm going to raise you on your view on critics there. I suppose that, if from a consumer point of view, if you're relying on awards, medals, prizes and points to make a decision about I'm going to, spend more on this or not spend more on this or choose this wine, then you're kind of relying on those judges to have a consistent view, because you want that, you want somebody with or a group of people with knowledge to have that consistency to say A is better than B. So if you've got judges all having different opinions, how do we know that, if we're cheating?
This is where the chairman or the person in charge of the table comes into. So I've often sat as the person, and what you do is you get everybody else's scores and then you berate them furiously until they all, they all back down and they agree to give the same kind of scores. So in the end, you get somebody who's acting as a tiebreaker. And certainly in the Australian wine show system, people discuss very vigorously and you start lobbying for people to come around to your view. But in the end, there is somebody who is recognised as an outstanding taster who gets the final say. So it's not like everybody goes off in different directions. At some point, you will get agreement. And this is where some of the European shows can award medals for very, very commercial wines, because you're getting the average of what they all think. And so average wines do really, really well. So let's talk about price.
Yeah. So I think there's again, really interesting to sort of start to delve into it. So in the study I was just referring to, they also looked at price. So what is the impact or the effect of higher scoring medals, in this case wines, and the impact on price? So for example, they found that for Shiraz, so let's go back to Shiraz, the example we were just talking about, if a Shiraz won a gold medal, on average it's $10.61, so that's the time then when the study was published, higher price point.
Oh, really?
Silver $3.82 and a bronze $2.43.
So that's fascinating. So the gold, silver, bronze sort of works.
Mm. Well, I suppose it's that when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, is it kind of chicken or egg? Is it that the wine is better, so in taste inherently, so commands a higher price? Or is it that because it's got a gold medal stuck on it, it can command a higher price regardless of whether the quality is actually better or not?
That's interesting. I do think that most of us who've been around wine for a long time can taste money in the wine. Like, I think, you know, you can taste it where there's been consultants and top oak and stuff like that. And so there's probably a bias towards, oh, this wine tastes more expensive, it must be better.
Yeah, so on the subject of price, I got in touch with James Miles. So he's the chairman and CEO of LiveX. So that's the kind of gold standard platform for buying and selling fine wine globally. And I asked him if they see a correlation between points, critic awards, and price. Mm. So they delved into their data for us, and they looked at their 2024 data. So thousands of actual prices that have been bid on and paid on the LiveX exchange. And they looked at wines that had at least three critic scores from recognized critics, and they adjusted for the critics' variation in scores. So what's great about what LiveX have done for us here is actually look at huge amount of data that they have from the actual wines and from the critic scores. So if we look at Bordeaux, so let's take Bordeaux, when they looked at that, so they were looking at the Premier Cru Classé, you know, right down to the fifth Classé, and the wines that scored between 89 and 90, 90 and 91, right up to 99 to 100. And when they analysed the data, what they found was that overall price does increase proportionally as the critic scores increase within each of those classes, so within each of those tiers. So yes, there is a direct correlation. Again, it could be that chicken and egg thing we were talking about earlier. But also the proportional increase in price, if you get a really top score in Bordeaux, is much more significant in the Premier Cru Classé, so in the highest price points, than it is at the proportionally relatively lower price points, if that makes sense. Mm. So it matters more, a high score from a critic in Bordeaux matters much more at the top end than it does at the midpoint of the Bordeaux market.
Well, that makes sense, I guess, because now you're talking about investment grade wines. And so critic scores become an important market signal. And I'd also expect them to be more relevant for Burgundy as well, just because there's more Burgundy to taste. It's much more difficult for a critic to sit and taste a vintage of top Burgundy because they're in very low supply. They're very, very expensive. So again, I think it partly comes down to the familiarity with what you're doing. I have seen that when the Emprimeur scores come out, that's the annual look at the top vintage of Bordeaux before it's released, you can literally see that if you're on a system that shows this, that merchants will dump and buy stocks all over the world because the score of the current vintage doesn't just impact that vintage, but it will change the prices of the older vintages as well. So, okay, so we've been through how scores are generated, how they're used and so on, but here's the big question. Do high-scoring wines taste better?
Yeah, and just before I come on to that, I just want to go back to something you said that was really interesting there about Burgundy. So back to the LiveX data, when we look at Burgundy, well, and they looked for us at Burgundy Grand Cru, again, there is a price increase for higher scoring Burgundy Grand Cru, but that better critic score or higher critic score doesn't have as much impact in Burgundy Grand Cru as it does in Bordeaux Premier Cru. So it's more influential.
I wonder if it's also if Burgundy is is protected a bit because it's just rarer. Like if you're a collector and you don't buy your Burgundy, you're not going to get hold of it. Whereas the thing about Bordeaux is that Bordeaux can produce fine wine at scale. So if you miss out this year, you can just buy it on the secondary market. That's interesting. Yeah.
Possibly. So sorry, I went back and you were asking me the big question.
So do high scoring wines taste better?
Okay, so let's go to my favourite, as you know, journal, one of my favourite journals, which is the Journal of Wine Economics. And this is a paper that they published back in 2008. So the title of the paper is Do More Expensive Wines Taste Better? So that's pretty good. So this was done by a bunch of economists based at University of Stockholm, also at Harvard and at Yale. So we've got
So when they got their grant, did the Stockholm people go, we have to go to the US, we have to do it, it's an important study.
How
does Stockholm end up with Harvard and Yale?
Well, they're all economists, so they, you know, and I suppose if you're an economist, if you're one of a pretty cool and interesting topic to discuss is economics in wine, which is what they did. So they had over 500 participants, so this is normal people, not critics, tasting wine flights double blind. So that means that neither the people tasting nor the people serving knew what the wines were, what the price was, or anything about them. Now, this study, remember, back in 2008, but I think it's, you know, clearly just as relevant today. So they were looking at wines, this is done in the US, priced between $1.50 and $150. So, you know, we struggle to find a $1.50 wine today, but you get the point. So they found that there was, yes, a correlation between price and overall rating. But they also found that the unless it's experts tasting, actually consumers on average prefer the cheaper wines.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they concluded that the average wine drinker, so that's normal wine drinkers, may not benefit from expert wine ratings. So they say he or she simply doesn't like the same styles or types of wines as experts. So these findings, I think, raise a really interesting question. So is the difference between the ratings of experts and non-experts due to an acquired taste, i.e. experts have a preference for a different taste or style compared to regular drinkers, which is what this article, this research paper in the Journal of Wine Economics is basically demonstrating?
That is such an interesting question. And I've got a sort of an answer to that, but I have to tell it to you in a roundabout way.
Okay,
so I have a bunch of Ukrainian friends who I practice German with on a Friday night, and we always open wine. So there's a group of people. And one night they brought a friend along who was a nurse from Ukraine who was taking time out from the war. And so because it was special, I opened a very expensive Bordeaux bottle that I'd been keeping for a special occasion. And one of my guests, who only ever drinks supermarket wines of about €5, hated it. I think the taste profile was just too far away from what she normally drinks. But the nurse had an extraordinary reaction. She'd never tasted anything like it, and she kept asking questions, you know, for the rest of the night through translation, which was quite difficult. So observing that, I think there's a nature and nurture thing happening simultaneously. I think some people's tastes change the more they're exposed to something, whereas some other people taste acutely right from the start, which is a long way around of saying I think people self-select into wine training. They were probably all likelier able to tell the difference between wines right from the start.
Yeah. So I suppose it leads us to, when we're thinking about awards and critics and points, to think about kind of consumer ratings or consumer preferences, which we've now got. So, you know, do these supersede now the critic scores and the medals? So if we look, you know, we've got a fantastic natural experiment in Vivino. Claiming, you know, 69 million users, you know, it doesn't really matter what they, it's a lot. There's a lot of people using it.
but
it's
loads.
A big number. Yeah, just loads. Let's just call it loads. You know, and that back to where we started, and you were talking about Robert Parker. So that compares to, you know, in the US, back in the 1980s, effectively you had just three main US magazines with critics, and they were reaching, what, 750,000 people, as opposed to Vivino.
Back in the days when people cared about magazines.
Yeah, when we cared about magazines, compared to Vivino, which is now, you know, having consumer-generated reviews and scores from 69 million, potentially, consumers globally. So perhaps we could say that, you know, peer ratings better explain wine prices than expert ratings. And are expert ratings therefore in decline versus what, you know, peer-reviewed recommendations or ratings now? So, Felicity, having discussed this, what's your view? Do award-winning wines taste better? Back to Chris's question.
Well, my conclusion is going to be, yes, they do, despite everything we've said. So, but I don't think it's this Albarino is a superior wine to this Cabernet. It's that out of all of the Cabernets that were tasted that day, this one comes out on top, whereas this Albarino comes out on top compared to the other five Albarinos in the lineup. So the score means it tastes better than other wines in the same category. The caveat is that scoring matters much less than it did in the past, firstly because wine quality has exploded and the chances of getting a bad bottle are pretty much nil. Second, more and more wineries are confident of their wines and they no longer enter into competitions. So the fact that a wine doesn't have a score doesn't mean anything. But where scores are critically important, in fact, is not at the consumer level. Having that distinctiveness is now important if you want to export, if you want to get your wine into an importer's portfolio. If you're unknown or your country is unknown, it's a third-party endorsement which still counts for something.
Yeah. And from my point of view, I suppose, you know, do I think, having looked at all this evidence, that award-winning wines taste better? I think on balance, award-winning wines taste good. And to your point that they are...
How tactful of you, Lily.
No, yes, to your point, you know, they are a strong representation, a good representation of Chardonnay or Albarino or, you know, whatever it is we're talking about. The evidence points that there is some consistency between judges and critics, but actually we've seen quite a lot of evidence that, you know, there's also quite a lot of variation. We know that from the evidence that awards and points do mean higher price points, but really only for the more expensive luxury kind of fine wine end of the market, which we could extrapolate, which is just that kind of correlation, you know, the chicken and the egg. Is it the wine is better, so it's a higher price and it's got an award, or the award is driving the higher price? So I think that, you know, the jury is still out on that one. From a consumer point of view, it is, yes, definitely, despite being kind of lower down the hierarchy of the choice cues, they are definitely clear heuristics that consumers can use as a shortcut to navigating, you know, which wine should I choose? So I guess I'm going to end on the question to you, Felicity, which is, next time you're selecting wine, maybe it's in a category or a place that you're less familiar with, would you choose one that had a medal or high points?
Well, Lily, you know how you're always saying that the most important thing is the recommendation of friends and family? The way I choose wines is I go to the wine bar and I say to my friend there, Dina, Dina, what have you got that's good? And that's what I buy. What about you, Lily?
I am with you 100%, which is recommendation from others is always a good place to start. So I would, you know, take that. But I think, you know, I will pay attention to, probably more attention to, points and critic scores than perhaps I had done previously.
And on that note, thank you very much, Lily.
Thanks, Felicity. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.